So Moav is going to have chapters 15 and 16. But unlike the two chapters that were associated with Bavel, 13 and most of 14, they're short chapters. Take a fast look, page 979, and you can see it. Chapter 15 is 9 sentences, and chapter 16 is 14 sentences. They much less real estate than what Bavel had. In order to understand the message that's going to be given to Moab, and I feel bad that Pesach is going to disrupt the middle of it. It's going to make it hard to remember. It's going to be like what we talked about with the Parsha, where you forget what you did last week. So people are going to have to just do review. That's the only way around it, in order not to forget before the 30th. But in order to understand the message about Moab, you have to go back to our national ark with Moab. Because what we're going to see here, and this is so beautiful when you read it inside and you see what's going on, what Yeshaya is doing. Yeshaya mixes the timeline, sort of blends elements from the timeline, so that he goes back and forth between Moab of his day and historic Moab. What is historic Moab to the Jews?
Lot.
Exactly. It's Lot. They come from Lot. And it's not just from Lot, but from Sodom. And that's so important as we read this section. He's going to go back and forth between events from the time of Lot and events that are happening in the time of Yeshaya. We even have a Midrashic hint at Bilam.
Yeah.
Bilam will make it into the Medrash as well. It's really a great read. So in order to do this, we do have to remember the nature of the relationship between us and Moab. So Lot and Sodom are identified with one trait, right? Which is? What is the trait that both of them are identified with? Sorry?
Hospitality or lack of it.
Both of them are identified with selfishness. Lot and Sodom, even though Lot welcomes in the Malachim, they are both identified with selfishness. Want to see it? Take a look at Bereshit, Genesis chapter 15, sentence 5. All the evidence you need. It is on page, 29? Chapter 15, sentence 5. I wanted to put it on the sheet, but I wanted to fit it all on one page. It's the ongoing tension there. Page 31, thank you. I wrote 15.5, but that's not what I meant. Sorry. What I meant was, right parsha, wrong chapter. Go back to the chapter 13. I wrote 15 in my notes, but I meant 13. Chapter 30, so it's page 27. Okay, you see that there. The Gam Lot Ha'olechas Avram Hayatzonu Vakar Va'ohalim. Lot had lots of sheep, cattle, tents. Land isn't big enough for the both of them, right? They have too much stuff. They can't live together. There's a fight then. There's a quarrel between the shepherds. Rashi gives you the classic medrash that Lot's sheep are invading other people's land. But even without that, even before you get to that layer, there's a fight between the shepherds. The Kenani and the Perizi are living in the land. Why did we bother to mention that? Look at Rashi. And then Avram says to Lot, listen, I don't want to have a fight between you and me. I don't want to have a fight between your shepherds and my shepherds. We're brothers. So here's the whole land in front of us, right? Everything is in front of you. Sentence 9. Separate from me. If you go left, I'll go right. If you go right, I'll go left. Sometimes that's what brothers need in order to get along. We're getting along just fine as long as we don't see each other. So, Lot, Vayisa Lot as Einav. Lot picked up his eyes. Vayares kol kikar ha'yarden, and he sees the entire plain of the Jordan. Kichulam hashketz, beautiful. There's so much water there. Before God destroys Sodom and Amorah, it's like a garden of God. It's beautiful. So what did he do in sentence 11? Vayivchar lo Lot eis kol kikar ha'yarden. So Lot says, I'll take the entire Jordan. Seriously? I'll take the entire Jordan. You can go there. That is all you need to know about Lot. Right? That's everything you need to know about Lot. He takes the entire shore of the Jordan. And then Avram is living in Canaan, and lest you think that he's going to be a good guy, but Lot will be okay, the text continues in sentence 12. Not only that, he's living in all these cities by the Jordan, via Ehal ad Sidon. And he decides, wouldn't Sidon be a great place to live? That's where I want to go. And the text tells you, don't think that Sodom is good right now and only going to go bad later. The people of Sodom were sinners against God. So Lot, right, this is our image of Lot, goes to live in selfish Sodom because he greedily chooses the entire plain of the Jordan. Avram, you can go somewhere else. And then what happens, of course, we know, right? The war between the four kings and the five kings. Lot is taken captive. Avram finds out. He goes to save Lot. He ends up saving the king of Sodom as well. And after the war, Avram is greeted by two kings. Right? Who are the two kings who greet Avram? Sorry? Moab and Ammon don't exist yet. Avram is greeted by two kings. Which two kings is he greeted by after the war of the four and five kings? Uh-oh. Turn the page. Take a look, please, in chapter 14, sentence 17. You see that? Page 29. Vayetse melech Sodom likrato. The king of Sodom came out to greet Avraham. Right, after he had finished with this war. But, sentence 18, Malkitzedek, the king of Shalem, brought out bread and wine. And he blessed him, and he blessed God. And then we get down to business in sentence 21 with the king of Sodom. Imagine the scene, right? Again, this is one of those things that you have to really read carefully in order to realize what's going on. The king of Sodom comes out to greet Avram, who has just saved him, right? And in the middle, barges in Malkitzedek, king of Shalem, and says, here's some bread, here's some wine, let's have it for bringing. Right? We're going to have a big party. We're going to thank God for all of this. And the king of Sodom is waiting to do what? What does he want to do? General rule, king of Sodom doesn't want to give you anything. Anything he gives you is because he is getting something better in return. Right? That's your rule. And that's exactly what is happening here. What happens is this. Malkitzedek comes out with gifts of bread and wine. Let's thank God. The king of Sodom wants to negotiate the division of the spoils of war. And he says to him, listen, you can have all the material, I want the slaves. That's what he says. Tein li anefesh for achush kach lach. And Avram says to him, I want nothing to do with you. I don't want your spoils. You do what you want. I don't want anything to do with you. The trait associated with Sodom, right, as marked in Pirkei Avot, is Shali, Shali, Shalcha, Shalcha. What's mine is mine. What's yours is yours. I'm not going to steal from you. I'm not stealing. But I don't want you taking anything as mine. I'm not willing to help. That's the trait of Sodom. And what that means for us is, first of all, Moab is a product of Lot, who is the brother of Sarah. In a sense, these are who the Jews could have become if things had not gone well. Right? In the same way, you can make that argument about Lavan and the Jews because of the biological connections as well as the fact that Abraham left Aram, the Seer Haggadah for more. But also, Moab is who we could have become if not for Abraham and Sarah being who they were. We would have been just like them. So that's number one. But number two, Lot is saved from Sodom in the merit of Avraham. There are all sorts of midrashim about the merit of Ruth, because Ruth is going to come from Moab. Also true, but take a look at source number four on your sheet, please. Vayizkor Elokim et Avraham, vayishalach et Lot. Right? Hashem remembered Avraham and sent Lot out of the upheaval. So the Medrash says, Uchnegdo hayubanam tzrichim lefra lanu tovot. Given that, their national history begins with Abraham's merit saving them, you would think that they would have been good to us. Not only did they not do good things for us, they repaid us with evil. And you get first the attack with Bilam, and then you get them teaming up with, of all people, Ammon and Amalek, in order to attack us in the beginning of the period of the Shoftim. And then after that, you get this record in Divrei Hayamim about an attack against King Yehoshaphat. And then in Echa, you find that they are accused of being involved in the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, the temple, as well. This is consistent with the selfish image of Moab. They're not interested in helping. They're not interested in gratitude. It's all about what they can get. Layla, you were going to say?
No.
Okay. That animosity continues throughout Tanakh. One of the things also that people often miss, why did Moab and Midian choose to hire Bilam to curse the Jews? What were they afraid of? No. Why did they hire Bilam to curse the Jews? What were they afraid of?
They were a large mass, and he was afraid of the attack against them, because he says, let us curse them because they are what, greater?
Nope. Don't mix up Egyptians and Moabites. Not all of our enemies were the same. Take a look at page 385. Numbers chapter 22, the beginning of the Parsha of Balak. Look at chapter 22, sentence 4, and tell me what it was that Moab was afraid of. And it's specifically Moab who's named here, not Midian. Chapter 22, sentence 4, is page 385. Yeah. Are they afraid of an invasion? Are they afraid of war? They're not afraid of war. They may even know, and this is speculation, but they may even know that we were instructed by God, Al Tatsaret Moab, Val Titgar Ba Milchama. We're not allowed to go to war with Moab. They're family. Also true. But the point is, they're not afraid that we're going to fight them. It's a NIMBY thing. Right? Not in my backyard. These Jews are coming in from the wilderness and they're going to eat all our resources. We don't have enough in order to support them and us. This is Lot and Abraham all over again. Right? We don't have enough land for the two of us. So what we're going to do is we are going to attack them by having them cursed. And see if that way they will be rejected by God, and then we won't have to worry about them. Their greed is reiterated in Chumash Devarim when God says not to marry them, their first three generations, right? We marry the females, not the males. They attack us in the third chapter in Shoftim, but then later on in Tanakh, after that, what's the next event that we know of that involves Moabites after their attack on us in the beginning of Shoftim? What's the next historic event?
Ruth.
Ruth, right. Ruth is from Moab. How did Ruth end up a part of the Jewish people?
She married in, right?
And she converts and so on, fine. But my question to you is, how did she get exposed to Jews in the first place? What happened?
Her mother-in-law.
They moved to...
The Jews moved to Moab. A family moved to Moab. Elimelech and his great big wealthy household left. Why did they leave town? Vayira of Baretz. There was a famine. Medrash fills in the gap. We don't want to support everybody else. So we are going to move out. And what place is an ideal place for somebody who says, I don't want to benefit others with my assets? Moab. Like finds like. They end up in Moab. It's the same thing over and over again. And then you get this very interesting war that happens in the times of King Ahab and ensuing generations between us and Moab. The war is recorded in Malachim Bet in Kings 2. But it's also recorded in the Mesha Stili, which is very worth seeing. If you take a look on your sheet, I thought it worthwhile enough that I gave most of the real estate here. This is an article on the Mesha Stili. It's some of the sort of thing that Jews ought to know about. They're going to find out. It's in source number 5. Right here. In the first half of the 9th century BCE, Israel was a mighty kingdom. Its king Omri, right, Ahab's father, owned at least 2,000 chariots. Even King Shalmaneser of Assyria admitted that Israel was a powerful enemy. Omri's son Ahab brought the kingdom to even greater prominence. This is the northern kingdom. However, King Hazael of Aram Damascus defeated Ahab's son Yehoram, and a general named Yehu overthrew the dynasty of Omri. That was Eliyahu's curse on the house of Ahab that they were going to collapse. There is archaeological evidence, there is archaeological evidence that part of the kingdom's heartland was even occupied by Aramean troops. At the same time, Moab, a vassal state of Israel, broke away from Israelite overlordship. Israel's fortunes were restored when the Assyrians attacked Aram in 842, right? That's going to happen. We haven't seen that happen yet. But Moab was lost. The story is told in the Bible and was more or less confirmed by a Moabite inscription. This is the Mesha Stili, that was discovered by a German missionary in 1868 in Divan, the ancient Moabite capital Divon, which we're going to read about in Yeshaya. It records the building of Karcha, which appears to have been a fortified quarter in the city. This was not without importance, because in the 19th century, many scholars had started to doubt the reliability of the Bible as a source for ancient history. The stela in which King Mesha offers his view, Mesha is the king of Moab, offers his view on the war against Israel was seen as an important argument against these skeptics. Now, what happened was, they actually found this stele, and it's written on black basalt. And they were so excited, and they wanted to get it and bring it to a museum and everything else. The local Arabs felt that basalt, this black basalt stone, had magical properties and could be used to protect their fields. And so they took a hammer to it, and they smashed it into pieces and distributed it among the fields. So they come back, like, wait, where'd it go? And they collected all the pieces and put it back together as best they could. So we have it, but we don't have it the way you had it originally. Fortunately, though, before this happened, they took what was called a squeeze, an imprint of the text. And based on that, we have a translation of much of it.
Where is it?
I believe it's in a museum in London, but I don't know why I think that. I could be making that up. I think it's in London.
The Cyrus Declaration is there, too.
Yeah, so maybe I'm thinking of the Cyrus Declaration. Well, they can't have it. To some extent, the inscription offers few surprises. The author of Two Kings claims considerable Israelite successes. The Moabite King Mesha makes the same claim. His victory, he says, is the result of support from the national god Chemosh, which you find referenced a lot in Tanakh, which was not a strange theological idea. The inscription also contained a reference to the four-letter name of God, right, which we don't pronounce, Yud, Hey, Vav, and Hey. Until now, meaning until the writer of this essay, this is the earliest occurrence of the name of the god in an inscription, meaning the earliest inscription that we have found with the name Yud, Hey, Vav, and Hey is the Mesha Stele.
It's in the Louvre.
It's in the Louvre, thank you. Okay.
The Mesha makes.
Hopefully it'll stay safe there.
Mesha makes me smile. I had a rib with my mother's family, we were with Fox, and Moshe.
Moshe was Mesha. Right. So I don't think Mesha was the same idea. But the translation of the stele offered below is based on the surviving remains and the squeeze that they took, adapted from a version by, I don't know how to pronounce his name. The language closely resembles Hebrew. Flip the page, please. What we're going to see here, you know, actually, I'm not going to read it aloud yet. We'll see it in a bit. But you're going to see the translation of it is going to mirror certain elements of what we're going to see here in Yeshaya, and that's going to be important. Okay, but that's just to know about right now, the Mesha Stele testifying to this ongoing rivalry between us and Moab. The selfishness of Moab is also potentially going to show up in chapter 16. But what we've seen so far is the arc of the relationship between us and Moab. One is up, one is down. And the selfishness associated with Moab all along. And And the prediction here is going to be the devastation of Moab. And the question is only, when is this supposed to happen? When is this going to happen? So the Dot Mikra edition floats the idea that the first half of the chapter comes from older prophecies before Yeshaya that he is now recording, and it's about earlier devastations of Moab, like the ones that we did to them. But most commentators don't take that view, and they associate it instead with Sanherib's invasion, with the Assyrian invasion. Because Moab is a potential ally for that northern kingdom Aram alliance. And this is a statement that the Assyrians are going to come in and they're going to level Moab. For example, take a look at Rashi in source number 6. Nitnabe Yeshaya Sheyavo Sancherev al Moab Vigalem or Vigalem. The Isaiah foresaw that Sancherev, the Assyrian king, was going to come exile Moab, and in fact, we'll see later on, at the end of chapter 15, a lion is going to come through. So some take that also to be Sancherev, others say that's the Babylonians, they're going to exile whatever remains of the Moabites. But the message here is really consistent with the overall idea in this section, that the audience is the Jews, the audience is not Moab. And it's meant to be a statement to us, God is with us, and don't seek alliances with the people around you. They're not going to help you. So the structure that we're going to see is, number one, chapter 15 as a whole, all nine sentences. The cities of Moab are in ruins. The beginning of chapter 16 will have an interlude regarding sheltering refugees. But it's not going to be clear which refugees we mean. Whether it means Moab should take care of us when we become refugees, or whether it's about the treatment of the Moabites when they flee. So we'll have to see that. But keep in mind, refugees are a big theme for Moab. Because Lot ran away from Sodom, right? Protected only because of Abraham. And because when we left Egypt and wanted to get into the land, they wouldn't let us go through. So the theme of taking care of people who are homeless and wandering is an ongoing theme for Moab. We have to see that. The land of Moab is then described as being in ruins in the second half of chapter 16 before the promise that I alluded to before, or I mentioned before, of Moab, you have 3 years to go. And then all of this is just going to come crashing down. That's the idea. How are we doing here? Oh, I see how we're doing. Okay. We have 1 minute till Pesach. Okay. So we're not going to start at this point on chapter 15, but one of the things that you should take a look at, and it'll save us some time when we do get back to this, is I brought you a piece of the translation of the Stele because I wanted you to notice the emphasis on city names. Mesha talks endlessly about the cities he conquered and the cities he built and the cities he destroyed. The same way that in the Torah, in Bamidbar 32, when we do our battle against Sihon there in that land, we list all the cities that we conquered in that area. And that's going to be the focus here in Yeshaya. He's going to list so many different cities. This is a style that you're seeing there. The cities that are encountered, the cities that are defeated. Remember, this is the first nation we actually defeated who had cities. Right? We fought Amalek in the Midbar. We fought the Canaanim in the Midbar. There were no cities. This is the first time we actually encountered anybody who had cities. But the emphasis on it is just a really interesting piece to me. I wonder if it goes back a little bit to Sodom and Amorah in any way, but we'll talk about that, God willing, after Pesach. We meet again, God willing, on the 30th. So I wish everybody a Chag Kasher v'Sameach, or Chag Sameach v'Kasher, whatever your preference is. Hopefully you get both. Thank you very much.